Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm the host of Your Legal Rights, Jeff Hayden. Beth Mora should be familiar to all of you. She is joining tonight as producer of tonight's broadcast. You're living, the life right here, where you grew up. Small technical problem. You're living the life right here where you grew up. You've always been here. Your life is here. You're a part of the community until, without reason, certain individuals perceive you differently because of your ethnicity or religion, and often heightened by events to which you're completely uninvolved and geographically removed. Tonight is the second part of a series focused on acts of hate or intolerance in the workplace, aimed at one's race, religion, appearance, or ethnicity. More prevalent than most folks are aware, anti-Semitism is very much on the rise. Acts of hatred, discrimination, fear, or prejudice. There were over 10,000 anti-Semitic incidents recorded in the U.S. since October 7th of last year, including verbal or written harassment, vandalism, or physical assault. When anti-Semitism appears in the workplace, it may lead to employees being harassed, marginalized, or discriminated against. It can take different forms. Possible scenarios include a business refuses to hire a Jewish man because he wears a yarmulke, a skullcap worn in public by Orthodox or observant Jewish men, or during prayer by others. Or a Jewish employee is fired by her supervisor who had shared with other coworkers that they didn't want the Jewish employee around because she adhered to Judaism and presumably supports the actions of the Israeli military. Or an employer denying a request for religious accommodation while accommodating similar requests for Christian employees. Federal and state laws protect us from discrimination at work. Tonight, Your Legal Rights, we examine anti-Semitism in the workplace. We invite you to bring us your questions. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. But please remember that our guests are here to educate and inform. They can't provide you legal advice. And the opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of KALW, National Public Radio, the Bar Association of San Francisco, or the employers or perhaps clients of our guests. But coming here to join you and pass on information, occasionally entertain, and tonight here to help you, we have Eric Kingsley of Kingsley & Kingsley. Eric concentrates his practice on employment matters, including wage and hour litigation, the claims of individuals who have been wrongfully terminated or sexually harassed in the workplace. Eric has been actively involved in the Anti-Defamation League, serving as the Los Angeles board chair from 2014 to 2016. And again, since 2021, has served as vice chair of international affairs. Also joining us, Mark Schickman practices labor and employment law and civil litigation in San Francisco. He was president of the Bar Association of San Francisco and served on the board of governors of the American Bar Association and the State Bar of California. Mark has served as chair of the Holocaust Center of Northern California. And Mark Schickman, Eric Kingsley, to both of you, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you, Jeff. Happy to be with you.
So let me start with a really basic question. What is anti-Semitism?
Well, I'll start us off. And anti-Semitism... has got, there's no one definition. there's a relatively broadly accepted definition, which is prejudice, discrimination, hate, or violence directed towards Jews or their institutions. There are examples like Holocaust denial or targeting Jews for violence or for a particular hatred. And it manifests itself in lots of different ways. And I guess it's appropriate to identify one other thing, and that is that Israel is part of the religious practice of 83% of Jews. In response to a Pew Center poll, they identified 83% of Jews found that Israel was either critical or highly important to their religious practice. So, you know, in the modern day notion, the idea that everybody is entitled to self-determination except for Jews. And so states for other entities is fine, but Israel as a Jewish state is not, is one of the modern manifestations of it. Eric, I'm sure you'd like to add.
Well, so just to follow up on that, Mark, so we have sort of two concepts here as we're talking about this, some more anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. And so I think in most cases, anti-Zionism is going to be anti-Semitism. That doesn't mean, of course, that people can't legitimately criticize the state of Israel. But when you say that the state of Israel doesn't have a right to exist, then that becomes anti-Semitism in essence. And then anti-Zionism looks like a proxy for anti-Semitism. You say, oh no, we're not prejudiced against Jews, we're just prejudiced against Zionists. Well, that's probably anti-Semitism in almost every single case.
And you know, to that end, it's not a whole lot different than people here. I mean, we tend to separate our politics. We may like this country, we may care for the people in this country. That doesn't mean we always agree with what the government does here. And that's even more so when your life is with the country so far away. You want the country to exist. It's our homeland. And that said, that doesn't necessarily mean you agree with the particular government that's presently in Israel at any given time.
That's exactly the distinction, Jeff. There are tens of thousands of Israelis taken to the streets every week saying they want somebody other than Netanyahu. So criticizing him is not problematic. Before October 7th of last year, many of us were involved in a discussion in Israel with regard to judicial reform. And it's very similar to a debate that's been happening here in the United States, appointment of judges and how do we think about the judges who have been appointed. Lots and lots of criticism. That's not anti-Semitism, just like criticism in the United States is not. But to say that the country has no business existing, the notion of saying, let's just get rid of everybody from the river to the sea means basically getting rid of everybody there. That's anti-Semitism.
We were just talking before the show started. You saw just on Monday, on October 7th, on the anniversary of this horrific day where 1,200 people were murdered by Hamas, innocent people, women, children, serious instances of sexual violence against women. And there was this celebration. And part of it was based on this idea of that, you know, Israel had it coming to them. And I don't understand how in civil society we can have a situation where folks are out on the streets basically reveling in the murder of civilians.
Two things I've learned. One is, no matter how bad a government, they can turn out a crowd. The worst despots in the world will have a crowd of people following them around. They can always turn out people for a parade or a showing or whatever. It may be a very small minority of the country, but they can turn them out and put on a show. And the second thing is, put aside where your loyalties are towards what government or what country. Most people on both sides of the issue, most people worldwide, want peace, want to get along. Governments can't always get along. And sometimes we need to separate whether you support your government and whether you like what they're doing. And whether, well, that said, I do have a caller. I would like to turn it over to Steve from San Ramon. Steve, welcome to Your Legal Rights. I think we may have lost Steve. So, Steve, you're welcome to call us back if you like. But Anti-Semitism is somewhat unique. It's very, very old. Who would like to talk about some of the roots of anti-Semitism?
So I can kick us off there as well. So first recorded instances of anti-Semitism have been just about 2,000 years ago. And the first manifestation, and it's worth noting, Deborah Lipstadt, who's the United States ambassador to the world on the issue of anti-Semitism, identifies anti-Semitism being different because it comes from a place where people assume that the Jews are responsible for something, and so they find what that thing is. It's a hatred looking for a problem rather than a problem which creates hatreds afterwards. So initially it was deicide. Jews until the 1962 papal conference were accused of killing Jesus. And this became the source of massive amounts of violence that was officially recanted 50 years ago, but the attitude is still there. There have been blood libels that have followed the Jews for at least 1,500 years, it's recorded, where a child goes missing in a community. People immediately start blaming the Jews for doing it. And the story came up that Jews would use the blood of children in their religious ceremonies. So that was another route. That we created plagues and spread the plagues. You would think that that was only the Black Plague we were talking about 1,000 years ago. But during the COVID outbreak, there were flyers all over the country that said that Jews had created COVID. And you know, you hear about us doing that, and it finally gets to the notion of Jews having control over everything. So when Marjorie Taylor Greene says that the California wildfires were caused by Jewish space lasers, there are enough people who believe it. So those are the roots, and it's always sitting there. It's a virus that is sitting there. It's waiting for two things in order to make it bloom. It's waiting for a political milieu where it can thrive. And we're looking at that right now. We're looking at that because, you know, we have one presidential candidate who's worried that a backlash against Jewish issues is going to cost that candidate swing states. We've got another candidate coming out and saying that if that candidate loses the election, it's the fault of the Jews. So it gets politicized and whipped up. And when that happens, it's up to the rest of us. It's up to the rest of society not to allow the few haters and the politicians that want to fuel them on from letting anti-Semitism take control.
Jeff, if I may, just to follow up on that, in the United States, it's sort of interesting. So what Mark was just talking about, how it sort of shape shifts. So if you look at the right, you look at the Charlottesville march in 2017 with the tiki torches, Jews will not replace us. There's sort of this idea from the right in this country that Jews are race polluters, that essentially that Jews are facilitating this mass migration of people into this country and that we're responsible for this. But then you look at the left is also talking about how Jews are responsible for the genocide of Palestinians and other groups based upon the fact that we support the state of Israel. And so it doesn't discriminate between left or right. And you look historically, going back even to the Nazi times, Jews were called communists and they were called capitalists. They were seen as like this moneyed interest that took away from the rest of German society, and they're also seen as being aligned with the Bolsheviks and that they were doing damage in that way. So we can't be simultaneously these two things, and yet we are.
And just to build on one point that Eric said on the accusation of genocide, one of the hallmarks of anti-Semitism is demonization and taking something that factually doesn't stand up, but just repeating the accusation and repeating the accusation and doing it. Genocide is a horrible thing. Genocide has a legal definition. If you look at what's going on in Gaza and all of the circumstances, most everybody would agree that it doesn't come close to coming to that definition. Every single death in Gaza is lamentable and even one is too many. But when you have a situation where Israel is trying to operate where civilians are being used by Hamas as human shields, those lamentable deaths are not the result of anybody intending to commit a genocide, but rather the fate of those poor people as Hamas's human shields.
Let me turn it to a caller. I'll take a call from Carolyn in San Anselmo. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. I have a question for the speakers. And I also want to make a comment that I'm finding the description of making generalizations here to be a little one-sided. I think it would have been better if you had someone from the current conflict. I disagree with anyone targeting Jewish people or any people for how their ethnicity or their religion. So, but my question is, because it was brought up about from the river to the sea, I have friends on both sides of this conflict, and I hear different descriptions of what that means, from the river to the sea. It does mean to some wiping out Israel. To others, it doesn't mean that. It means some type of a contiguous way for between the West Bank and Gaza. And I also, so my question is, I'd like to also have from either speaker or from both a description of what Zionism means. Because I also hear different things about that. I hear a very xenophobic description about Zionism and Israel only being for Jewish people. And then I hear from other people it just means supporting Jewish ethnicity and religion. So I'd like to hear their take on this. And my final comment is, it would have been better if you had a more balanced talk here, because I was brought up Catholic. I realize that the Pope didn't do anything to help the Holocaust victims during World War II. But at the same time, I was never brought up with that idea of Jesus killers or anything. I've only heard about that, like, in the last 10 or 15 years from Jewish people. But I never learned that. I never learned any hate in my upbringing. So,
Carolyn, I'm happy for your upbringing and that you didn't have to hear that stuff. I can tell you a lot of others have experienced it. But I also want to address something you said. Before I turn it over to my guests to respond to some of the points you brought up, you mentioned about being balanced. We were here 2 weeks ago with the executive director of CARE in San Francisco, as well as the American Bar Association's co-chair of the American Bar Association's Task Force on Islamophobia. We did that show 2 weeks ago. So this, we really want to move rather quickly through the introductory stuff so that by the time we get toward the middle of the hour, we can talk about what form prejudice in this form takes in the workplace.
Eric, do you want to start?
I can start if you want. Maybe you want to take the Zionism question. I can take the river to the sea. In terms of the river to the sea, I mean, it's sort of interesting. I mean, I think a lot of these kids chanting this slogan on college campuses may not even know what river and what sea. And so just for our guests, the river is the Jordan River and the sea is the Mediterranean Sea. And essentially what the chant calls for is, to use the German word, Judenrein, to have no Jews between the river and the sea, where some, you know, 7 million Jews currently live today. And so I don't think there's any historical precedent to suggest that it's a chant to mean living in peace and harmony and a one-state solution. And so I think this is something that's sort of been misrepresented in the media, that there's sort of two meanings. But then a final point on that is, if any other ethnic group in our society today were to be called something that they found offensive, people would say, wait a second, if African Americans find this to be offensive, you shouldn't say it. If Latinos find this to be offensive, you shouldn't say it. And yet, for some reason, Jews are not allowed to define what they find offensive.
And to jump on that a little bit, so I agree with you, Carolyn, that half the people who are chanting from the river to the sea don't know what it means. And as Eric points out, doesn't know which river, which sea. What most people will point out to you is that the way you accomplish that is by killing every Jew in Israel. And if you look at the Hamas charter, where that term comes from, and I really, you know, urge you to read it, you will see exactly what they are talking about, which is death to everybody who is in Israel. Please read the Hamas charter. You'll see it. Let's talk about Zionism for a second. And let me back up to say, you know, I'm a believer in the two-state solution. And I think that if there's a partner for peace out there, that is the view that most everybody I know is looking for peace in the region is looking at. So it's not Zionism to the exclusion of anybody else, but it is there for their Zionism is the statement of the aspiration of the Jewish people to return to their ancient homeland and to have a homeland. There are some people who talk about, quote, the greater Israel, where they're seeking huge amounts of territory. That's not the political will in Israel. And if you look at every deal that was accepted, when you look at the concept of Zionism, it's to have a homeland, not to have the entire territory, not to exclude the existence of any other homeland, but to have a homeland. The two-state solution, I think, is the answer and the way to lay that out. So anybody who suggests that Zionism is essentially saying this entire area is ours, no Palestinian state, that's not what Zionism stands for. The last comment you made is that you know, you grew up without any vestiges of anti-Semitism like Jeff. I am glad to hear it. I got two suggestions. I mean, one, polls have been taken in terms of anti-Semitic attitudes in America. And as Eric points out, the incidence in the United States has grown from 10% to 20% in the last 5 years. And it's the result of 2,000 years of culture that has imbued it. And it's very hard to get rid of 2,000 years of culture when that happens. My suggestion, there's something, if you Google Harvard IAT, Harvard, and it's called for an implicit attitude test, and it'll dig down into whether you've got unconscious biases on gender, on Jews versus non-Jews, on race, on various other things. And I find it very self-revealing to take these implicit attitude tests, because you don't realize your implicit bias. That's what implicit bias means. You don't know that it's there. These tests will show you whether it's there or not. And I urge everybody to go to the Harvard IAT and take this self-diagnostic tool. I think it's very revealing.
Carolyn, thank you for joining us. I would like to turn it to Pamela from Berkeley. Pamela, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Thank you for giving a history of anti-Semitism, the blood libels, the things that way predate the modern state of Israel, and about the implicit bias. For some people, this seems to be this visceral anti-Jewish feeling. But having said all that, there's something that was said earlier that I have to respectfully disagree with, and that is that, you know, the conflation between anti-Zionism or very fierce criticism of the state of Israel with anti-Semitism, and they can be the same, but they're not necessarily the same. I know a lot, I'm Jewish myself, and I know a lot of Jews who are not Zionist, who are even define themselves as anti-Zionism because they don't like to have any religion in their government. I mean, there's Jewish Voice for Peace, there's Not in Our Name, there's Tikkun. There are many, many Jews themselves who are fiercely critical of Israel, and it's not anti-Zionism. So I think we have to sometimes be careful of conflating the two. It can be, but it isn't necessarily. And I'm not just talking about since October 7th. You know, there are people who are fiercely criticism of the occupation, of what goes on in the West Bank, and that's not necessarily anti-Zionism. I mean, I'm sorry, anti-Semitism.
So I believe, Eric can speak for himself, I believe we both agree with the thrust of what you said. again, a year ago, the current government tried to push judicial reform that would have weakened the courts in Israel. And there were 25,000 to 200,000 people on the streets every single week against that. And most every one of my colleagues here in the States opposed that. So to be critical of Israeli policies is generally not anti-Semitic. If Roger Waters or Mel Gibson says it, I think it probably is anti-Semitic, but generally it is not. The distinction is calling for the destruction of Israel. And by the way, there are, you know, there are no universals. There are people I know who I respect greatly who have developed a theological attitude that that there shouldn't be an Israel until the Messiah comes. And I don't think they're anti-Semitic. I think that there are a few of those. But that's the distinction that I think is to be drawn. Criticizing the Israeli government for any of its policies, generally speaking, is not a sign of anti-Semitism. Saying you believe in self-determination for the Palestinian people to have a Palestinian state, but saying no such similar right exists among Jews, generally speaking, anti-Semitic.
Thank you for that. I also want to, you know, I agree with everything you said. I also wanted to go back to the idea of anti-Zionism, though, where there are some people who don't believe in any religious state, and there are Jews who are anti-Zionist, but not for religious reasons, for political reasons. So, you know, we can agree to disagree on that. I think it's not inherently anti-Semitic if you hold the same standard to all countries, you know, to not believe in, you know, the idea of a Jewish state or a Muslim state or a Christian state. You know, as long as you believe that across the board, it's not necessarily anti-Semitic, although it often is.
And Pamela, just to add to that, there are people in Israel, a lot of folks living in Israel who themselves are secular. They consider themselves Jewish as a matter of ethnicity, but don't necessarily want a religious state. So it does get to be a complicated picture.
And I think people need to understand that Israel isn't a religious state in the sense that you're mandated to do certain things. There are certain aspects in terms of citizenship, automatic citizenship if you're a Jew, that you can get. But it's interesting, though, that the discussion worldwide, I mean, nobody talks about England being an Anglican state or Saudi Arabia being a Muslim state. And it just seems that the Jewish state always gets singled out. And yet the world, for the last thousands of years, has tried to kill us. And so part of the reason why Jews rejoiced in 1948 when Israel became a state is because it was sort of a safe haven. I mean, in some ways it really isn't, because now they just attack the Jewish state. But at least the concept was is that this would be a place where Jews could be safe, even if their home countries decided to abandon them.
And again, I've got to agree with your last point, too. I usually refer to this as the John Lennon theory. I mean, there's an imagination. Imagine there's no country. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for. No religion, too. So, you know, the philosophy there, no countries, no religion, that presumably means no Israel. John Lennon in that song is not being anti-Semitic. So you've got to, of course, you've got to look at what's there. And you are right. To 16% of Jews, Israel is no part of their religious identity. And that's completely respect that part of it. But if you're attacking something that is part of the religious identity of 84% of Jews, as is the case for any other ethnic group, it's viewed to be anti-Semitic.
And similarly, I think that it would be no different if you talk about any other ethnic group in the country here. If you were to say, this has nothing to do with religion, but we're going to wipe out your homeland and all the people in it, most people would have a problem with that.
Conversely, if you say, this has nothing to do with religion, but I'm against, you know, governments who commit these acts, period, and this is horrific, and I have to stand up for it. It may not have anything to do with religion. It may have to do with this is your politics, and it's the same with many governments who are, you know, oppressive.
Absolutely. Anything, you could easily criticize most governments on the planet right now for the various things that they either support or participate in. You're listening to Your Legal Rights. on KALW 91.7 FM San Francisco Bay Area, where we will be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
Pamela, I'd like to thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights. I don't think there's as much that separates you from my guests as it might be. It seems that as we fleshed it out more, you seem to be more in agreement. I appreciate that opportunity to do so. I do need to move on. I'd like to talk to Leo in San Francisco. Leo, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for having me. I have three points. The first being sexual violence on October 7th. There is absolutely no evidence that has been presented for that. Secondly, I take exception with something that your guests were mentioning, that, you know, Jews can't be capitalists and communists. But of course they can. Jewish people are not a monolith. And to say that they are is actually anti-Semitic. And the third thing I want to say is about the slogan, "From the River to the Sea." You guys are saying "from the river to the sea," but the second part of that chant is actually "Palestine will be free." So their Jewish people can exist as they did prior to 1948 in that part of the world, and they will continue to exist after Israel is gone. And I'll take a response off the air. That's all I got to say. Thank you.
All righty, Leo, thank you for joining us. I think that a lot of the people who use that chant interpret it quite differently. I don't want to spend that much time with it. I really do want to move on. We have another caller lined up.
I do think, though, Jeff, it's important to emphasize that the sexual violence was well documented on October 7th, and that there's videos that Hamas had GoPro cameras that they took back to Gaza, and that information is out there. And I believe Sheryl Sandberg has a documentary video, I can't recall the name of it, Mark, perhaps you know, which documented the sexual violence on October 7th. So it's just a plainly not true.
It is so distressing to hear. There's this notion, believe women, but it's got an asterisk. Believe women, except for Jewish women, because even if there's video evidence of rape and mutilation, you'll have somebody coming in and just saying there's no evidence of it, which it sounds like a Monty Python skit when you have all the evidence that's out there and you can have claims like that made. It's extremely distressing. And this is the kind of thing, I do want to say, this is the kind of thing that people need to push back about. There's this phrase, when you see something, say something. When you hear something, say something. Especially, by the way, people who are in the domestic violence community. And it's a vibrant community. It's a professional community. It's a community which protects the rights of women. When they hear comments like you just heard, that there's no evidence at all of sexual violence, when even the United Nations report identifies that there is, you hear that, you got to push back and say that's not true. I'll leave it at that.
Some people won't accept evidence unless it's been personally presented to them. They'll just stick their head in the sand and say it doesn't exist. Whether that's done with hate or not remains to be seen.
The name of the film, if people want to watch it, is Screams Before Silence. And in fact, one last point on this is that when the Hamas terrorists went into the communities around the Gaza envelope, they were instructed to actually engage in rape. There were many that were captured by the IDF in the aftermath of October 7th, and they told their captors that they were actually instructed that sexual violence was part of the plan.
With that, let me turn it to Marcel in Berkeley. You're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hello?
Marcel, you're on the air. Welcome to your legal rights.
Thank you very much. Thank you for taking my call. I just want to put a slightly finer point on the discussion you had previously with the lady caller concerning Zionism. And I realize you want to move on, but I do think you do a disservice by automatically equating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism existed for centuries in Europe, and Zionism was a movement that started, around the 1880s with Herzl. And there was significant things that happened, after the Balfour Declaration by Great Britain between 1918 and 1939 that led to the dispossession of Palestinians from lands they had occupied. And then you had the violent expulsion of over 700,000 Palestinians from what is now Israel. I think that there's...
Okay, I'm going to cut you off for a moment. I don't mean any disrespect, but we are really getting bogged down with histories and what's happened overseas. And I'm trying to save some time to talk about what the show's about, which is anti-Semitism in the workplace and what you can do about it. The same way I did the same show 2 weeks ago with Islamophobia. And the point is, we have people that are experiencing stuff. I would like to tell them where to go. So I mean no disrespect, but this is really moving in the direction of a different show. And talking about the history and legitimacy of the State of Israel is really not the show that we're doing tonight. But I do appreciate your calling in and wanting to be part of it. What I really wanted to talk about tonight was how this might look in the workplace and what people can do about it.
So if you're talking about, and it's a really important question, religious discrimination in the workplace is unlawful, and an employer owes an employee two obligations. Number one, an obligation not to discriminate. And Jeff, this goes to some of the examples that you led the show off with. If somebody in the exercise of their religion wants to wear a yarmulke to work, and they're derided as a result of it, it's discrimination and harassment. If they're not getting jobs that they should get because they're Jews, discrimination and harassment. There's a federal law called Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It violates that. And you go to the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, file a charge, and that starts that ball rolling. On the state side, there's a Fair Employment and Housing Act, same kind of provisions. You go there to the Department of Fair Employment and Housing. You can file a charge of religious discrimination there. So just like race discrimination, a gender identity discrimination, a sex discrimination, religious discrimination is against the law. All of the same kinds of remedies, feel free to use them. But in addition to not discriminating, there's an obligation to reasonably accommodate an employee's religious practices as long as it's not causing undue hardship to the employer. And there's a recent case that speaks about what the limits of that are, and an employer has got to do more than just a little in order to accommodate, reasonably accommodate the religious practices of their employees. What does it mean? If you're going to have a company function and somebody says, I need to get some kosher food, it's probably reasonable that you get them kosher food. If there are shift scheduling issues and somebody cannot work on a Jewish holiday that's coming up, or on a Sabbath, to be able to accommodate their schedule to change it. They don't have to do it if it causes an undue hardship, but if it doesn't, then they've got to accommodate you. So, Jeff, in the broadest terms to get it started, an obligation not to discriminate, and there are remedies, and an obligation to reasonably accommodate your religious practices as long as it does not cause an undue hardship.
So by implication, a very small business, maybe a store with two or three people that work there, may have a better reason to deny the shift somebody wants for religious reasons than would an employer that has countless people that they could move around in order to make that happen.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And, you know, this concept may be known to people in the disability field because it's the same terms, right? You've got a reasonably accommodated disability if it doesn't cause an undue hardship. And as you say, Jeff, if I've got a warehouse with 20 people working in it, and I need to leave for the day because it's a Jewish holiday. Rosh Hashanah was last Thursday. I can't be there. I need to be out. If I've got 20 other people doing it, employers can have a hard time showing that it's an undue hardship. If I've only got one person who's pulling stock out, and I can't figure out how to do without that person, my obligation, it may be an undue hardship for me. It does differ, Jeff, depending on the size.
Even a show this size. I did Islamophobia 2 weeks ago. It would have been ideal to follow it with this show the following week. But for various reasons, I mean, we don't want to be right on the neck of the holiday. There's no way we could have done it Wednesday, so we put it off a week.
Jeff, one point about this, you know, a lot of people may think to themselves, well, are Jews really getting discriminated against? But there's actually a lot of bias in the workplace. There have been some surveys on this, and some of the attitudes are sort of shocking to some degree, that they did a survey of hiring managers about Jewish applicants, and 38% believe Jews had too much power and control. 38% also believe Jews claim to be the chosen people, and then 35% believe Jews have too much wealth. And so I think these types of anti-Semitic tropes do create circumstances in the workplace where perhaps Jews are not promoted or hired by certain hiring managers. It's obviously not widespread, but there are pockets, obviously, where this can become a problem.
Well, if these are employers, if these are hiring managers, and we're at 38% on these things, I wouldn't say that these are not widespread. That's troubling.
That is troubling. Yes, absolutely. I mean, I don't know if they're actually acting on that, but they hold those attitudes. So just because someone has a thought and they don't act on it, obviously that's not discrimination. They would actually have to not promote somebody because they were Jewish or something else like that.
Can't blame somebody for the things that pop in their head that they realize and censor out. It's quite different when people have it either because they're not aware of it or because they embrace it, and they either act on it or speak from it, whatever it may be, very different. And let's be clear, hate is hate, whether it's anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, other forms of discrimination based on race, based on ethnicity, based on a whole lot of things. Hate is hate, and the more that you're aware of it, the more that you treat people differently because you're not aware of it, it's... We need to work towards snuffing that out.
And as you say, it can start with one group, but it quickly spreads to others. And which is why the fight against hate is so universal. The Justice Department came out with a stat last year. Jews are 2.4% of the population. 60% of all religiously based hate crimes are placed against Jews. So, it's an incidence 20 times as high as the incidence in the population. And again, it's kind of, it's buried. As again, Ambassador Lipstadt says, part of the problem is that it's a huge problem, but nobody identifies it as a problem. And they think that it's not. So it's especially troubling because of that double whammy.
And it hasn't always been this way. In recent history, it hasn't been this way. This is really ramping up pretty quickly.
Well, you know, you mentioned in the intro about the 10,000 instances in the last year. ADL has been keeping track of this for a number of years. That was a statistic from the Anti-Defamation League. If you go back just 10 years to 2014, it's under 1,000 instances. So there's been a 10 times increase in anti-Semitic instances in a decade, which is striking that it could rise that fast.
And Jeff, even our political leaders who think that they are friendly to the community and speak well of the community abroad and have some, perhaps in the immediate family, say things that really fuel it.
Absolutely, yeah.
I don't want to say which leaders, I don't want to necessarily make tonight about politics, but or about people that are running for office, but it's fairly widespread. And so many of them are saying things with an incredible level of unconscious bias, or perhaps wanting to bring in a certain constituency that shares that bias. So they'll say a few tropes and step back.
The statistics that you identified, you know, really show the flow during the last century. Before World War II, anti-Semitism was really rampant in the United States. Henry Ford, the greatest industrialist probably of the 20th century, had this pamphlet that he sold, that he distributed 4 million copies of, called The Problem of the International Jew. There was this guy, Father Conflin, who would get 15 million people listening to a radio program every week. Then came the Holocaust and the evidence of what happened to anti-Semitism and the statistic. I have recently heard something bad against Jews before World War II. Was it about 37%? Years after the war, 5%. It dropped significantly. And I think that a lot of us thought that it had disappeared, but it keeps popping up.
Henry Ford indirectly had a bearing on my name. My grandfather went to work there. They did not like the name that they thought was Semitic. It was actually Russian because we had borrowed it from another family in Russia a few generations earlier. So he changed the family name, went back to work there, got the job at Ford because he took on an anglicized name. Was gone in a month. He hated it. But in the meantime, the name is what it is. Let me turn it over to Catherine from Berkeley. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say as an aside, I really appreciate this program, by the way. I'm Jewish and I've been... Sorry, that's my dog. I've been tracking this issue. I did have to say about the ADL, it's been kind of distressing. My understanding is that they changed the way they track anti-Semitic incidents. So the increase is partially because they're counting incidents that are really more purely anti-Zionist. And while there is sometimes overlap, sometimes there's not. And they've also been rather more biased towards focusing on Israel-related incidents versus anything else. And the distressing part is it just makes it harder to track what's really going on. And there is other, indeed, anti-Semitism that's going on. But because they're losing trust, it's just harder to know. And that's it. Thank you. I can take the response off the air.
And just a quick reply to that before I hand it on. The numbers that I gave out earlier of 10,000 incidents since October 7th of last year, those were not from the ADL. Those are from the FBI. And they also are accompanied by a note that hate incidents of all sorts are probably the single most underreported crimes in America.
So I want to agree with a couple of speakers who pointed out that anti-Semitism predated the existence of the State of Israel, predated October 7th last year. When I presented to the ABA its resolution condemning anti-Semitism, it was February 2023. There had already been a rise of 400% in anti-Semitic episodes over the prior 2 years. So it is not about Israel. Anti-Semitism is not about Israel and Gaza. It is simply the latest excuse. Now, it can't be ignored because it's the big trigger today. And it can't be ignored because there are kids who are walking around college campuses wearing Jewish stars who, because they're wearing a Jewish star, are surrounded or harassed or blocked or those kinds of items. So it is the newest trigger. And people don't like it when I say that anti-Semitism is no more about Israel and Gaza than it is about the Black Plague or whether Jews use blood for matzah. All of them have been excuses that have, you know, come up over the centuries. So I I do agree with that. And we've got to keep our eye on the ball of anti-Semitism and recognize that it goes well beyond the issue of Israel-Gaza.
UCLA had a protest, much like many of the other schools in the country, where they were protesting what's going on in Gaza. And the students blockaded several instructional areas, including the school library. But they also were checking identification because they decided that certain days were going to be days without Jews, and they did not allow Jewish students to access those areas. It's very widespread and
so that was
very tolerated.
So that was troubling. That episode was really troubling. Having said that, an injunction was issued. When we talk about legal rights, an L.A. federal district judge issued an injunction against UCLA, because another thing that some of those demonstrators were doing is they were blockading, and you, in order to get through the blockade, you have to say, I am not a Zionist, or else you can't get through. And this federal court judge identified the stat we've laid out before, that to more than 80% of Jews, and in the plaintiffs of this case, said, my longing for Israel is part of my religious identity. Anybody who is looked at a Hebrew prayer book will know that for the 1800 years between when the Romans kicked the Jews out of Israel and today, there's been a longing to go back to Israel. And it's part of the religious identity. And that federal court judge said, not only, Jeff, your identification, no Jews today, but that judge said, when you say, in order to get through here, you've got to disavow Israel, it violated their religion, and the injunction issued.
And it can get very dangerous, too. There was an incident where there was a subway in New York City where there was a video and an individual said, all Zionists get off the train, you know, and they were like sort of cheering. And so you can see how just in a public space, you could have, it'd be very dangerous for Jews, especially if you wear a Magen David or, you know, a high necklace or something that identifies you, a religious person that wears a yarmulke, that you could be targeted and their violence can escalate very quickly in our society.
And with that, this is the only place where Eric,
I hate to cut you short.
Yeah.
But we are out of time. I did tell you I need to give you each about a couple minutes. We're really going to hold you to that. Mark, you want to go first?
Thanks. So I guess my message, I got a couple of messages. What I was going to say a minute ago, and I'll preface this with 15 seconds, we're huge believers in the First Amendment. So I do have to say that even the worst anti-Semitic things are allowed to be said under restrictions of manner and means of communication. And it's worth pointing that out. Blocking people from campus, circling them around is not part of it. So with that, what I really wanted to say, Jeff, was the following. It takes everybody. It's going to take everybody in order to stop anti-Semitism. We'll never get rid of it completely. It's been here for 2,000 years. There are hardcore anti-Semites out there. They're not going to disappear. And it's been pointing out there are going to be politicians who are going to fan those flames. So how do you stop it? You stop it by having people understand that, like any other kind of bias, if you see anti-Semitism, stop it. You wouldn't stand there if members of the Asian American Pacific Islander community were mocked and spoken about in pidgin English or slanting their eyes at them. You'd sit there and you'd stop it.
Oh, I think too many people would stand there and watch it.
So my message out there to Jeff is that to stop this, it's going to take all of us that don't go along with the haters, that don't go along with the people who are trying to fan those flames.
I guess it's me next. So
it's
Jeff,
up to you.
Thank you so much for having us on the show and highlighting this important issue. I always just like to say that anti-Semitism is the canary in the coal mine. You know, when miners go down and there's some toxic air, if the canary starts to have problems, they know that they got to get out of there real fast. And so in the same way, as anti-Semitism in a society increases, it means the society is sick. It means that there's a problem in society. And over history, you can look throughout history, as populations kicked out its Jews or persecuted its Jews, those societies tended to wither and have real problems into the future. And so I think it's in everyone's interest. It's not, this isn't a Jewish problem. This is an American problem. This is a global problem to address this problem of anti-Semitism that's on the rise, to make our societies and our democracy safe for our children for the future.
And let's be honest, hate is hate. This is one. Jews aren't as visible. They're not as visibly different as some other minorities. The hate is the same. And for some reason, right now, many people are turning a blind eye to it. I got an interesting tidbit from Joanne Marr. Joanne is my right hand here. I couldn't do this show if not for Joanne. And Joanne has told me that intent to discriminate is difficult to prove, or is often difficult to prove. And any controversial statement that appears to be offensive targeting marginalized groups can always be disputed as to its meaning or intent, such as some of our callers took with that one chant that's going around. And often the people complaining are perceived as being oversensitive, and that's precisely why many remain silent in the face of discrimination or hate speech. I don't think I could have put it better. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 910. We have a few seconds left, and I do see we have another caller. I am going to try to take your call. Rich from Fremont, you're on the air. You have about 30 seconds.
Yeah, I just wanted to say it's a tall order combating this when you have people, very prominent members on Capitol Hill, saying, you know, the Jewish lobby, it's all about the Benjamins, which Ilhan Omar said, and no real repercussions. She's still supported by the Democrat Party. It's a real tall order combating it when you have, you know, somebody prominent like that in that position putting those kind of tropes out there. Thank you for taking the call.
Thank you for joining us. I wasn't going to mention specific politicians. I will say it's pretty widespread across the board. There are people that say it that may be well-meaning, maybe not. Some have said some pretty horrific things from higher offices than that. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight, we continued our series of hate and discrimination at the workplace with a discussion of anti-Semitism. My guests tonight, Mark Schickman and Eric Kingsley. Tonight's show was produced by Beth Mora and yours truly. Please be sure to join Your Legal Rights, where next week we will look at Proposition 36. Best of all, we take your calls and answer your questions at Your Legal Rights, Wednesday at 6 o'clock. Big thanks again to tonight's guests and to all of you for listening. And at the control, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night, and zealously guard your legal rights.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.